Does any other senator desire to be heard on the motion made to adopt the Senate committee substitute for Senate Bill 518 made by the senator from Berry County in Southwest Missouri? Senator from Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have an amendment.
Send it forward. Has it been distributed, Senator?
It has not been distributed. I would ask that it be distributed, and I would not close on it until it is.
So noted. You care to explain the amendment, Senator, and move for its adoption?
Yes. I move for the adoption of the amendment, which basically there is a lot of information about managed care that implies that it may not save so much money as it is thought to. And my amendment would allow for the department to collect up enough data that would demonstrate once and for all whether or not managed care actually saves money. Just for the purpose of discussing that, Medicaid managed care was originally formed as, quote, an improved delivery system that would emphasize primary care, educate beneficiaries on the benefits of healthy lifestyles, and implement a host of cost or of care management initiatives. By 2010, about 70% of the nation's 60 million Medicaid beneficiaries were enrolled in some form of managed care. Due to the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, states are encouraged to cover all citizens with incomes at or below 133% of the poverty level. A lady named Deborah Freund researched Medicaid managed care programs in California, Missouri, Minnesota, and New Jersey between 1983 and 1989. The research collected compared claims data for beneficiaries in both the managed Medicare programs and the fee-for-service programs. The conclusions of this research stated that, quote, managed care enrollees utilized fewer health services than their fee-for-service counterparts, as both emergency room utilization and physician utilization declined, end quote. With this information, it was also concluded that managed care beneficiaries were less satisfied with their overall care. The research implied that the lack of satisfaction could have been due to their reduced access, and there were few cost savings, partly because inpatient costs remained high, but also because of high administrative costs and problems with the capitation rate-setting methodology, end quote. A summary of her conclusion stated the following, quote, our research suggests that available research does not support most claims of large cost savings or improved quality of care for children and pregnant women as a result of managed care. Now, this is just the first of many studies that have been done looking at managed care. And there has been at least one study that tends to indicate that it saves money, but this study basically said that managed care has not been proven to save money. So here we are considering whether or not to expand managed care statewide. I think that for sure the one outcome of this would be that we would enrich the managed care companies. They're going to make millions of dollars if we do this. You've heard it said that 54 of our 113 counties have managed care. When the managed care companies extend that out to the rest of the counties, they're probably going to make millions of dollars, and it's going to be at the expense of our Medicaid beneficiaries who, as you've heard me talk about with this one study, are probably not going to be happy with the new situation. So the question really is, have states really saved money by implementing Medicaid managed care? First, peer-reviewed literature finds little savings from Medicaid managed care on the national level, but some states have been more successful than others. A study done by Kirby, Macklin, and Cohen was the only peer-reviewed study that looked at national data and found overall cost savings. All others agreed that such initiatives in managed Medicaid, quote, either cost neutral or could actually end up costing more than traditional fee-for-service programs. Third, the most recent study done by Dugan and Hayford looked at a dozen years of national data. These authors conclude that, quote, state initiatives have no effect on overall Medicaid spending. So you've got to ask yourself, why do we want to do something that the people aren't really going to like, that isn't going to save the state money, but it is going to make certain companies very wealthy? One of the things that always confounds me as a physician has been, over the years, sitting on budget and appropriations, has been the actuarially sound line item of our budget. Every year we have to increase the amount that we pay managed care companies by several million dollars. I think this year, as I recall, it was $50 million. Just to keep their payment actuarially sound, whereas as a physician, over many years, my pay hadn't gone up at all. In fact, it's also very frustrating to me that I'm not in the I-70 corridor, but I would be paid, a pittance practically, certainly far less than my cost of seeing a Medicaid patient. In the I-70 corridor, the physicians get paid a lot more. I always kind of thought that equal pay for equal work was a good thing. Herring and Adams conducted a study which looked at the national data from 1996 to 2002 and concluded that, quote, direct medical costs remain relatively constant, and add that when administrative costs are added in, the overall cost in the managed care systems could well be higher than under fee-for-service. Well, here's another study that says we might actually be shooting ourselves in the foot by going to managed care. It might actually cost more. In fact, I've asked the department to provide data over the years as to whether it's care is cheaper in the I-70 corridor versus in the rural outstate areas. And it turns out that it is, in fact, more expensive in the I-70 corridor. But then they always included with that the information that health care is more expensive in the I-70 corridor because it has Kansas City and St. Louis. And so, you know, those people demand a higher price. So maybe that's true. It's hard to sort it out. That's why I'm offering the amendment. A person named Burns, a person named Burns looked at national data on disabled adult beneficiaries from 1996 to 2004 in managed care. The researcher found no difference in cost between managed Medicaid and fee-for-service. Three people named Iser, Curry, and Moretti analyzed data from 1999 to 2000 on the California Medi-Cal program and linked Medicaid data and birth outcomes. The conclusion was, quote, transition to managed care increased costs as more pregnant women went without needed prenatal care and ended up with high hospital-based NICU costs, which is exactly not what's supposed to happen when you put people on care. Next, Dugan studied managed care with beneficiaries still in fee-for-service from 1993 to 1999, in which he stated the following, quote, spending in the managed care counties was 12% higher, even though there were no noticeable improvements in health outcomes. He speculated that the higher costs could be attributed to higher payments to providers, higher administrative costs, or HMO profits. Well, that's exactly not what we want to do. And so that's why I'm offering this amendment. Basically, if we're going to be doing managed care, we need to know whether we're saving money or not. And that's the point of my amendment. Number 8, quote, studies conducted by consulting firms on behalf of interested groups find overall cost savings due primarily to reduced inpatient utilization. The article goes on to say that even with the concern of bias and the overall thoroughness of the study, quote, none were subject to the rigors and oversight of the peer-reviewed literature. So, does it save the state money? Well, the great majority of the studies show that it actually would cost the state money. One study has been shown that it might save the state money. Most of the testimony that we heard was by the managed care companies themselves. Well, they might have a bias, being that they're going to make a bunch of money if we expand this program. So then the next question is, do Medicaid managed care beneficiaries have better access? So, first, Medicaid beneficiaries in fee-for-service programs, quote, generally have relatively poor access to high-quality office-based physicians and instead typically receive primary and preventive care via hospital emergency rooms, an outpatient clinic, community health centers, and public health clinics. So that's fee-for-service programs. Next, sometimes managed Medicaid will provide beneficiaries with improved access to health care, but this is dependent on the state. And I've said for many years that we're in violation of our federal law. The federal law says that Medicaid beneficiaries will have substantially the same access to healthcare providers as people in the general population. And having been a Medicaid provider for many years, although I don't currently see Medicaid patients, actually, or any patients,
really,
much, I can tell you that I spent many years struggling to find providers for my Medicaid patients. Like, I would try to get a person with a severe headache into a neurologist, and I would end up having to send them to Columbia or Truman Medical Center from St. Joseph, which to me was outrageous, being that there were several providers in St. Joe. The problem was that while almost all the doctors in Missouri are Medicaid providers, many of them would only have like one or two slots a day for Medicaid patients. So when you would call up, you would say, I need an appointment for my patient. And they'd say, what kind of insurance does the patient have? If it was anything but Medicaid, then I would say, when can I get them in? And they would say, how about tomorrow, the next day, you know, a week from now. If it was Medicaid, it'd be like, how about a couple months from now? Or maybe 3 or 4 months from now. And then I would have to talk to the actual physician and say, you know, I'm really worried about my patient's health. I mean, this could be something real serious. And sometimes they would work them in, sometimes not. But it was absolutely obvious true that that Medicaid patients did not have the same access to health care providers as the rest of the people. And so when I would point that out, nothing was ever done about it. It was just a, well, it would cost us too much of the, as a state to be in compliance with the federal law. Nobody ever really cared. If we were to pay physicians and specialists enough money to guarantee that there was substantially equal access, it would have been $100 million. And I was always told, well, we don't have $100 million, so there's nothing we're going to do. I was always kind of hoping that the federal government would step in and say, hey, you're in violation of the law, but they never did. They it would cost them even more. If it cost us $100 million, it cost them $300 million. Next, many studies, including Herring and Adams, along with Green, have similar conclusions. They conclude that managed Medicaid initiatives do not change access to care and do not increase primary care provider participation in Medicaid. That's important, but even more important is the specialists. It's, you know, now we have federally qualified health centers, and when a person goes to an FQHC, the physician or that FQHC will probably receive about 3 or 4 times as much for the visit as what they would if they went to a private physician, such as myself. My reimbursement was, depending on the level of service, could have been like $19. They might get $100, which, while I mean I think that it's important to have access, it's also important to treat providers fairly. The issue of whether or not managed care provides better access is also a very state-specific issue. But in a Kastner study, it was found that managed care enrollment had basically no impact on beneficiary access, none at all. So is this another reason why we need to expand managed care statewide? I mean, if the argument is that there's better access, maybe that's not true. And I don't know if I really, explained, but the data that I'm talking about came from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation study on Medicaid managed care, costs, access, and quality of care. So then the next question is, do Medicaid managed care beneficiaries receive higher quality care? I mean, that's an important question. If we're going to expand managed care, we need to know that. Managed Medicaid advocated to promise better access at a lower cost with higher quality care. But there is little research that fully examines the effectiveness of the disease and care management programs. Pregnant enrollees on managed Medicaid versus fee-for-service Medicaid are, quote, no more likely to deliver a healthy baby than their counterpart. So here we are, we're going to put moms and kids on managed care for another 60, 80 counties, however many it is, and the managed care companies are definitely going to be enriched, as are their shareholders, but will it really be helping, you know, our Medicaid population? ISER conducted a study in which they analyzed California managed care. It was suggested that, quote, managed care enrollees actually had higher rates of low birth weight babies and neonatal deaths. Why is that? It's because managed care can really be described as rationed care or denied care. I mean, just on the surface, the providers are being underpaid many times less than their cost for taking care of this population of people. How is it possible that you can save the state money and actually provide better care when you're already paying many providers less than their cost. It's unfathomable. It is difficult to fully measure the quality of care received due to a combination of complex factors in various social determinants. So the conclusions that were reached by the study were, number one, it is hard to come to a general conclusion on Medicaid-managed care on cost, access, or quality. Number two, peer-reviewed literature has found little savings at the national level, but there has been some success by certain states. Number three, the majority of studies that do have cost savings are not peer-reviewed and were conducted by consulting firms on behalf of interested parties, creating at least a perceived bias. Number four, there is some evidence that managed Medicaid does provide some improvement to access, but it is state-specific and depends on how access is measured. And then last, literature on Medicaid managed care and quality has focused to date on examining whether pregnant beneficiaries have healthier babies than their fee-for-service counterparts. They do not. So that summarizes my concerns, but aren't all my concerns. Here we are thinking about banning managed care statewide, but the national data would appear to show that it's not going to save money, it's not going to improve access, it's not going to raise the quality of care of our patients, at least not for sure. But one thing that we can be certain of is that it is going to enrich the managed care companies. So with that, Mr. President.
The senator from Buchanan.
May I inquire of the senator from the 10th?
The senator from the 10th district is not in the chamber. We would ask the sergeant at arms if he will summon the senator from the 10th. Senator from the 10th is now in the Senate chamber. Do you yield to an inquiry from your colleague from Northwest Missouri?
I do.
She does proceed.
Thank you, Senator. Let me tell you what happened here.
Okay.
The senator from Barrie brought his bill forward, and he was done presenting the bill, and nobody stood up. And I was aware that you wanted to stand up and talk about this bill some, but seeing the need that if nobody was going to stand up, the bill was going to be closed on, I stood up.
Okay.
I would, at this point, willing to just kind of withdraw my amendment and allow you to move forward.
Okay. I appreciate you giving me the heads up, Senator. I'm sorry I was off the floor. You may not know this, but in addition to being a senator, I am also a landlord. And I have a tenant who lives in my property here in mid-Missouri.
Oh.
And I woke up this morning to a very, very cold house. It turns out the furnace went out in the middle of the night. And while I am a tough individual who could probably, you know, make it through the -2, you know, night tonight, the former senator from the 11th, who is my tenant, is sort of a fragile, gentle human being. And my concern was, Senator, that I needed to make sure that I got the heat turned back on for him so that his delicate sensibilities could be taken care of.
Now, the senator from the 11th, if I'm not mistaken, he is now a member of what, the probation and parole?
No, he's a tax commissioner.
Oh, yes,
a
tax commissioner. That's right. Yes.
And because of that, of course, he lives here, you know, year-round now and needed a place to stay, and I had an extra room, and so I'm happy to do that. But that comes with certain responsibilities. So I was off the floor, I apologize, making sure that he had heat for tonight.
Well, is he doing well?
He is. He's doing fantastic. He's really fitting well in well over in the other building now. I tell you, having him over there in a building full of bureaucrats, I believe the bureaucrats have been a little bit nervous around him. I think he's a little bit like kind of a killer whale in a small tank swimming around, and no one really knows what to do with him yet. But he's doing fantastic. He's healthy. He's happy. He's a little cold right now, and that's what I've been working on this morning.
Well. I'm
physically cold. You know, it's cold outside.
I know. It is chilly. Chilly today, hot tamale.
Oh, that's my. Wow. That's impressive. Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Senator from Buchanan.
I would like to withdraw my amendment.
Send the amendment back, please. We are back on the adoption motion of the Senate committee substitute offered by the Senator from Berry. Does any other senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 10th.
I inquire of the Senator from the 11th.
Senator from the 11th District in Eastern Jackson County is not in the chamber. We would ask that the Sergeant at Arms retrieve said Senator. Senator from the 11th is moseying on to his desk. Do you accept an inquiry from your colleague from the 10th?
Yes.
He does proceed.
Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon. I was upstairs listening to the debate, taking care of some other things. I would like for you to know that this morning I had an 8:30 hearing to get to, and the city of Jefferson City did a great job of shoveling my street, and they put snow all over my car.
Oh, no.
The hardiness of the people of District 11, I went out there for 45 minutes and shoveled. So I won't be standing here anymore and having you disparage the toughness of the people from the District 11 any
actually,
further, Senator.
Actually, you know, I need to back it up a minute. So while he is cold right now, I will tell you that his hardiness is actually, you're right, it cannot be questioned. Here's why.
Okay.
So my house sits on a state road, which has been well plowed. It's looking great. But as you may or may not know, I have a very, very, very long driveway. Yesterday, the former senator from the 11th, from the stock of the very type of people
yes.
that you're talking about, rather than waiting for my lawn guy to come and shovel the driveway with his snow plow, the senator, former senator from the 11th, went out there with a hand shovel and completely shoveled the entire driveway so that I could drive back to the Capitol and do something.
Well, there is perhaps some strong evidence that becoming a bureaucrat has softened the gentleman that we're referring to.
Right, but after
nicer
his hard
ties,
work,
you know, a big corner office over in the Truman Building, I can see that, and we're concerned about it back in our district. But I'm glad to hear that he was out there shoveling.
Unbelievable. And out there with a hand shovel doing, a quarter mile worth of just unbelievable.
Well, then I would recommend that you get the heat fixed, Senator.
That is my first priority. That is my first priority. But while I have you here,
yes,
wanted to talk to you just a little bit about an amendment that you had circulated.
Yes.
And I don't believe that you've offered it yet for discussion.
Not quite yet. I know the senator from Buchanan had some discussion on this bill, so I was letting that play out and let him
Absolutely.
Have his voice on it.
Absolutely. Senator, do you want to explain to me your amendment, or do you want to offer your amendment, or how would you like me to proceed at this point? I'm happy to do it in any way, shape, or form.
I would like to offer the amendment.
Okay. I'm going to give you the opportunity to do that at this time.
Hey, Mr. President.
Senator from the 11th.
Does Mr. President have an amendment that has been distributed?
Send it forward. Did you say, Senator, it has been distributed?
Yes, it has.
Okay. Are you requesting a waiver of the reading, Senator?
I am. Thank you.
You care to explain the amendment, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. President. the Senator from Berry is proposing a bill today to expand managed care throughout the state. A good recommendation. And as he inquired, the chair of the Medicaid committee that we had on an interim basis, he talked about why it was important and that this recommendation came from our committee, which was put together to study Medicaid transformation and reform. Mr. President, my amendment deals with the number one thing that was discussed during these committee hearings. It deals with, and I'll go ahead and read, beginning January 1st, 2015, individuals aged 19 to 64 who are not otherwise eligible for Mo Health Net services under this chapter, who qualify for Mo Health Net services under the section, who have the income at or below 133% of federal poverty level plus 5% of the applicable family size as determined, shall be eligible for medical assistance under Mo Health Net and shall receive coverage for the health benefit packages. So, Mr. President, what we're doing is that we're raising the eligibility of Medicaid to this level, which will allow us as Missouri taxpayers to draw down federal money through the Affordable Care Act and to make sure that not only are more people covered, but we're seeking that reimbursement to help hospitals, small businesses, and ultimately the people of Missouri, as it is a big boom for our state. Mr. President, this is something that makes so much sense that many states around the country have decided to do exactly what my amendment does and draw down federal money. It brings in money to our state that our state payers have paid. It expands the number of people who are covered and is the right thing to do. Mr. President, we haven't talked enough about the need for this, because when we had our interim committee, we had, and I'd like to reference the minority report on this, we had many, if not most of the people, testify in favor of this amendment. Of the 63 people who appeared before the committee, the number of people testifying in regard to this amendment and the idea in this amendment was 33. The percentage of people testifying regarding this idea was 52.4% of the people who testified. The percentage of those in favor of this idea who testified were 93.9%. And there were people against this idea, and they were 6.1%. The percentage of those testifying who were told that this idea was beyond the purview of the committee was 0%. What was unfortunate is, as we heard these good ideas from the people of Missouri on what a great idea this was and how it draw down our money that we pay as taxpayers back to our state, when it came for a final committee report, it was not included. I think that it was not included by pure politics, as opposed to the good show me common sense that we should be having in our state. So I offer this, Mr. President, as a idea as time has come. Other states have done the same thing. I'm offering this amendment because it makes sense with this bill. I am also open to other ideas to draw down federal money, to expand health care for people in the state of Missouri, that makes sense. Many states have gone their own way and done things in their own way, and I'm all for a Missouri solution. But it looks like as though we are talking about Medicaid right now, and I want to make sure we had at least one discussion this session and not happen what would happen in our committee where we didn't even get to discuss it. So with that, I renew my motion and ask for a roll call vote on this amendment.
The senator from the 11th has asked for a roll call vote. The requisite number of senators standing, a roll call vote will take place. Senator from Boone was first on his feet. For what reason do you rise?
Inquire the senator from Nottoway.
Senator from Nottoway County is also not in the chamber. He shall
may,
be summoned.
May you summon him, please.
He shall be summoned at the request of the senator from Boone by our sergeant at arms. Senator from Mercer, do you yield to the inquiry from your colleague from Boone County?
Do.
He does proceed.
Thank you, Senator. How you doing?
I am great.
Good. Okay, so I know that you were in a meeting in the back room, so just so you know where we are, we've got the underlying bill, but then now we've got basically Medicaid expansion being added on to this bill.
Okay.
And it's just, from what I understand of the amendment, it's just pure Medicaid expansion.
Okay.
Basically raising the threshold to 133 or 138% of the poverty level, depending on how you figure it. But I wanted to talk to you about that.
But clearly we can't afford it. So let's talk through the financial realities as well as the delivery of care realities.
And this is why I'm inquiring of you, because so much of the conversations that we have are about, I mean, we all talk about public policy, but someone has to connect that public policy to actual dollars.
Correct.
And, you know, those dollar amounts, they're empirical. I can show you on a spreadsheet. They are what they are. They're not subject to change. It's what we've spent. And so I think it's interesting because I was on a talk show on the radio in Columbia about 2 weeks ago, and somebody called in and the issue of Medicaid expansion came up. So I started talking about these numbers, and the person who called was kind of chastising me because I'm not in support of expansion. And by the end of that call, the caller said, I had no idea what you're saying, that this was true, what you're saying about these dollar amounts. Why aren't more people talking about that aspect of expansion? And I can't answer that question. But now that we have it out on the floor, it is our chance to talk about the reality of what expansion means.
And let's start with, if we could take a step back, let's start with how funding Medicaid works.
Specifically,
right. Medicaid is not a program like the foundation formula, where we say, here's how much money we have, we put a finite amount of resources in the pot,
right,
and then they split it up.
Right.
In Medicaid, and specifically what we're working on here, there's a threshold that's set.
Right.
And anybody who meets that guideline gets it.
Right. And you're either in or you're out of Medicaid.
That's right.
So our discretion to change that amount does not exist.
Correct.
So let's talk about that.
Yep.
So right now in the state of Missouri, we've got about 900,000 people on Medicaid.
Correct.
We're paying for them now. So everything that they need in their care, we pay for.
And in conjunction with that we spend approximately how much for those 900,000?
It's a 60-40 match, okay? So
right.
First of all, you have to look at for the 900,000 people, we pay for everything that they get. And the way it works is, in order to participate in the Medicaid program with the federal government, for every dollar, we have to lay 40 cents on the table, and then we get 60 cents from the feds.
And in our 40 cents is comprised of general revenue as well as the provider tax.
Correct. Now, let's talk about this for a minute before we get to expansion. Because expansion is somewhere between 300 and 400,000 more Missourians being added on to Medicaid. So before we get to that, in the discussion of does anyone really think that you can add 300,000 to 400,000 more people on welfare and it not cost you anything more or
right.
save you money?
No.
That alone is an absurd argument. But let's step back about the existing population. Because it's important, because the existing population is really not affected by expansion. And I think the governor, when he went around the state, talked about the fact, well, the federal government's going to pay 100% if we do expansion. They're going to pay 100% just for that additional strata of 300,000 to 400,000 people. They're not changing
for the first 2 years.
For the first 3 years, yeah.
But last year was one of the years.
Well, that's true.
Now we're on 2 years.
That's true. Now it's 2 years. But the question is, the existing 900,000 are still at a 60-40 match. And I want to give you some numbers because this is absolutely relevant to a lot of other things. The higher ed discussion I had yesterday with the senator from the 21st, the discussion I know we're going to have on this floor on K-12, from 2009 to 2014, actual numbers, so the money that we have to cough up of state general revenue to continue in that Medicaid program is $982,585,943. It is a 30.2% increase in state GR and GR lookalike spending just from 2009 to 2014.
Now, here's one more fact, and maybe you have it in that spreadsheet. The most stunning fact, I believe, is that if you take all 50 states and you look at what percentage of our budget is spent on Medicaid, Missouri is number one in the nation.
Right.
37% was my last number I read. 37% of our total budget is Medicaid. The next closest state is Pennsylvania, at 29%.
Right.
We're 30%
higher. And we're climbing every year on this population.
And that's without expanding. That's without expanding, by the way.
Right. Right.
All right. I just want to set the base.
That is the trend that's been occurring. And as I said, that's a 30.2% increase just from 2009, just under $1 billion of general revenue. Now, here's why that's important, because everybody knows, well, for this year, it's about a $25.2 billion budget. And, you know, you've heard me say this before. You divide it into thirds. You got that first third, which is federal pass-through, which we can't change the amount or where it goes. Now, the 60 cents that we get on the dollar is counted in that first one-third.
Correct.
Then we've got the second one-third, which is money that comes in under state law, but is for a dedicated purpose. So regulations on banking, insurance. We charge a fee on those things, but it goes back to serve for, you know, licensing and all the other things. That leaves the last roughly one-third, which is just for this year over $8 billion.
Yep.
But of that just over $8 billion for this year, we spend over $3 billion on Medicaid, on our share of Medicaid. Because we're over $8 billion, closer to $9 billion total on Medicaid. Yep. But just our share of discretion, and it's a joke at this point that we call it discretionary general revenue, because there's nothing discretionary about it. Either you're in the Medicaid program or you're not, and if you are, we're going to cough up just over $3 billion of discretionary general revenue to stay in there. Just over $3 billion goes to public education, and only $800 million of that goes to higher ed, almost all of it's K-12. We got about a little over $700 million for prisons. And there's really nothing left except for a smattering of other things in that discretionary general revenue. Now, if everyone wants to know and they're wringing their hands of why the funding formula, K-12, is $640 million underfunded, if they want to know why higher ed is almost $300 million below where it was just 5 years ago in funding, it's not rocket science. I can tell you and show you on a spreadsheet exactly where all that money has gone. It has gone to our share of Medicaid.
And tax credits.
It's mostly to our share of Medicaid on an annual basis. We can have that argument separately, but I can tell you $982 million of it has gone to Medicaid. And that doesn't change.
And it's continued. And that, Senator, in fairness, is Medicaid thresholds that were changed in 2005.
That's correct.
Had that not happened, we would be even substantially higher.
There's no doubt about that.
Exponentially higher.
And I wasn't here at the time, but I have talked to several members who have said that that process and that vote was one of the most difficult votes they ever took. Had that vote not have been taken, these numbers would be substantially worse. Substantially worse. So, and then if you look at increase in federal spending, in other words, that first one-third, that pass-through money, that in Missouri in the last, well, since 2009, has increased by 40%, almost $1.5 billion. So,
of money they don't have, by the way.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute, too. Because there's two parts to this whole discussion. One is what we can afford in the state of Missouri. And we've already made the decision, not publicly, not the media hasn't reported on it, that we have consciously or subconsciously, however you want to categorize it, made the decision we are no longer going to fund K-12 education in higher ed the way we used to because we're going to fund Medicaid. That decision was made and it's happened and I can show it to you on the spreadsheets.
And as a percentage of general revenue, elementary, secondary, and higher education continue to be a smaller and smaller percentage.
Right, and they're going to continue to be.
That's right.
Whether we do expansion or not, they're going to continue to be. Expansion doesn't fix that problem. Okay, so that's one issue. The second issue is, and it's the governor's argument, well, hey, just, you know, sweep that under the rug. Don't look behind that curtain. But, hey, look at all this free federal money we're going to get. Well, we should care about that. If not from a sense of national pride and national security, from a sense of all those other things that need to be funded more appropriately in conjunction with the federal government, which are going to be impacted by this. And I handed this out, and it's very, very timely. It's an article from The Hill. It came out yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that.
I've handed it out. And this is a report on the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan entity, which is supposed to objectively report on financial status and a lot of other things going on in Congress. And they do that. This came out, their numbers came out yesterday.
Yep.
And if you look at this report, what they say is, Obamacare or Medicaid expansion, as proposed under the Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, is going to have negative effects on employment that would be substantially larger than were anticipated at the time Congress passed the law. The CBO said the equivalent of 2.3 million workers would be lost by 2021 compared to its previous estimate of only 800,000, and that 2.5 million workers would be lost by 2024. It also projected that labor force compensation would be reduced by 1.1% from 2017 to 24, which is twice the previous estimate. They projected total employment and compensation will increase over that period, but the increase would be smaller than it would have been without the health care law. Now, that's another argument that's been raised. Somehow this creates jobs. Every indicator is this shrinks the economy or shrinks the level of growth. And we can talk about that because all we're talking about is let's expand these welfare programs. But why on earth aren't we talking about expanding the economy before we talk about expanding anything? Do you know what general revenue growth is as of today in the state of Missouri right now at this point in 2014? 0.61%. That is our growth. As far as I remember, because I get these updates every day, I think we've been under 1% now for a month, over a month.
So here's the, okay, let me follow up question real quick. The consensus revenue number is what?
The one that we agreed on with the House is 4.2%.
Okay, and the one the governor budgeted to?
Well, that gets real dicey, and I'm glad the media is here to hear this because it gets very difficult because what happened was we had agreed on a revised consensus revenue estimate for the remainder of 14 at 2.4%. So the governor was on board with that. But then once we got that done and moved into the conversation of the consensus revenue estimate for 2015, the House and the Senate were at 4.2, but the governor wanted 5.9%, with no evidence whatsoever to even remotely suggest that that type of growth will occur. Well, when we wouldn't give it to him, and we said, fine, I'm sorry, we can't agree with you, House and the Senate are going to budget to 4.2, what the governor did, and I didn't even know he was going to do this until he gave his state of the state, he went back and lowered his 5.9 to 5.2, but raised his revised consensus revenue estimate for 14 to spread it out over 2 years. Now, the amount of additional money, which is about $500 million additional general revenue that won't be there, he's still spending that. But how he calculates it, he made it a little fuzzy.
Now, there's one more point that's important to be made here. The last time the General Assembly and a governor could not agree on a consensus revenue estimate was in 2003.
Yes, before my time.
2004.
Yes.
It was for the last decade, we've always been able to get to an agreement. I mean, this is a dramatic department from the way that we have operated for the last decade.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
People don't, I mean, most of us here don't pay attention as closely as you do, but a few of us have been in your chair before, and major deal.
Right, and here's what's important about it. Arriving at a consensus revenue estimate is not a political determination. It is an objective economic analysis looking at a whole host of things that we then come together. And again, it's the Senate, the House, the governor, and an economist from the University of Missouri.
Right.
And so some of those things that we look at, we don't make this stuff up. It's not political. But we rely on Moody's Financial Service for part of the information that we get. And one statistic alone that Moody's provided us, which is data as of the end of November, so it's still fresh data, was that nationally, job recovery since coming out of the recession nationally is 80%.
Right.
So the U.S. has recovered 80% of the jobs it lost during the recession. The Midwest as a region has recovered 68% of the jobs it lost. So we are much worse off than the national picture. But the most telling stat in this is, as a state, the state of Missouri, in this same calculation, recovery of jobs lost since the recession is 37%. Yeah. Want to know why we're at 0.61% general revenue growth right now, over halfway through the year? We don't have any jobs. It's absolutely anemic.
I'm telling you, this is a real problem.
Right. And rather than talking about how we can fix that, we're talking about basically taking more general revenue and a shrinking general revenue pool and putting it towards Medicaid expansion. This isn't an argument about whether people want to provide health care or like the population that should get health care or don't like them. This is simply about what you can afford. And no one wants to have that conversation.
My exact argument about low-income housing tax credits.
Well, I'm sure we'll have that discussion at some point as well. You know, another interesting thing, this was in the Columbia Tribune, I think it was last week, there was an article on the cost of higher ed.
Yep.
And, for example, it's relevant to the discussion I had with the senator from the 21st yesterday. And the Consumer Price Index since 1985, adjusting for inflation and everything else, has increased 121%. The cost of health care, which is the whole motivating factor for why apparently we're having this discussion, because we've got to make these substantial changes, because the cost of health care is going through the roof. Health care has increased in cost since 1985 by 286%. You know what the cost of higher education has increased by in that same time period? 538%. So we're having this huge discussion about health care because of the escalating cost. It's only grown at 286%. The cost of higher ed's grown by 538%. But that's a separate issue. I wanted to raise that, though, because it gives you some perspective on what we think is important, I guess, and what we don't. But I did hand this article out. And I want to address the other part of the argument, because as I said, there's really two parts to this argument. One is what we can afford is the state of Missouri, which clearly we can't afford this, and I want to talk more about those numbers in a minute. But the other issue is what can we afford nationally? And I know that people say, well, you're state senators. Don't worry about that stuff that's going on in Congress. They worry about that. That's absurd, patently absurd. We represent the state of Missouri in all aspects that we can be relevant. And we can be relevant in this process. And so when you look at the issue of the national debt, CBO says that alone expansion is going to add at least $1 trillion to that debt. Now, I talked about this last year. When Congress raised the debt ceiling to $17 trillion, and the entire gross domestic product of this country is just over $16 trillion, what Congress was doing is taking us above 100% GDP to debt.
Yep.
Now, that's the same thing as you getting a paycheck every month, knowing what your paycheck is, and then going out and spending over 100% of that. It's going to catch up to you at some point. And when you look at these numbers, and this is on the second page.
Yeah, these are some very telling numbers.
Right, of what it contributes. So it's going to add at least $1 trillion onto the debt. They believe that from 2014 to 2023, the government will add $7.3 trillion in new debt to the debt. And the CBO estimates that by 2023, the gross debt of the United States will be $26 trillion, up from the 25 projected, in large part because expansion is going to add at least $1 trillion on. A year later, they say it's going to be $27 trillion. I mean, that is, you know, people want to have a concept of how much money that is. That money will never be paid off. You are adding debt. I mean, it's longer than just two or three generations of debt. It weakens the country, and it is unbelievable that that issue of what this adds to the debt is not being discussed. And again, as part of this issue that nationally you've got no economic growth, yet this is what we're going to do?
So, two problems, right? One, what you've just articulated about where we are as a country, the fact that we're going to be at $24 trillion, $26 trillion in debt. But even as concerning as that, is there was an article, I read it probably 2 weeks ago. It lists every year the most economically free and the most economically robust countries in the world.
Yep.
The United States has been on the top 10 list since that list has been published. This is the first year ever that our country is no longer considered one of the top 10 top 10 places in terms of economic freedom or in terms of economic growth. And that is a long-term problem that if we don't fix the standards and quality of life that we have been blessed with, our grandkids and great-grandkids will not have the opportunity to share.
No doubt about it. Now, the counterargument to this is what the governor made in the State of the State, that if we don't take it, why, you're just sending your tax dollars to Illinois and to New York.
That's not true.
Yeah, that's absolutely not true. Because unlike this, remember when you and I were here and the federal government pushed all the stimulus money?
Yep.
And in order to get the states to take it and not have conservative states reject it, they did build into that stimulus money, if a state doesn't take it, the amount that they were allotted, went back into the pot, and then the other states got to take it. That is not how
Medicaid works. Agreed.
Medicaid has requirements. If you meet those requirements, your payment is your payment. And whether Florida expands or any other state expands has nothing to do with how much we get or how much we pay.
That's correct.
Our payment is only based on our numbers, our requirements, and whether we do expansion. So this concept somehow that if we don't take that money, it'll go to other states and they'll do it, it doesn't work that way. Whether other states expand or not is completely irrelevant to the amount that we do or do not get and the amount that we do or do not pay.
If we were true about funding our priorities accordingly, what we would have is we would have a Medicaid system that we put X number of dollars in regardless of how much money that is, that's what they have to live on.
Correct.
Just like schools, just like we run every other part of government.
But right.
That's not happening right now. And until we fix that fundamental disconnect, I don't know how you ever have truly financial security going forward.
Right. Now, since 2009, that increase of $1 billion, just since 2009, an increase of $1 billion of general revenue in the state of Missouri has basically taken $1 billion from public education. I mean, that's what's happened.
That's correct.
It's why the formula is 640 short. It's why higher ed is 300 million less where they were in 2008. Aside from that, when we look at expansion, even the hospitals agree, because the federal government says, well, now it's down to 2 years, like you pointed out, for that additional strata, they're going to pay 100% for the first, well, it was 3 years, now 2 years, and then it goes basically to a 90-10. That 10% added to what we have to pay is $250 million. Not total, $250 million of general revenue per year starting in 2019. You know, pretty much everyone who's looked at this, even the hospitals who want this so badly, agree that's the number.
Yep.
Now, what we get into is they make the argument, but yeah, sure, you're going to have to cough up $250 million, which, by the way, is going to come from public education. It's the only place that you can find that money. So in addition to the trend that we've had on the $1 billion, it's going to get worse for public education if we do this. Aside from that, they say, well, but you can shift populations around and you can move some people from this program to that program, so there'll be some savings. Maybe there will, maybe there won't. All I know is it's guaranteed $250 million of general revenue per year more starting in 2015.
Right.
And do we want to do that? Now, that's one part of the equation that we know. If we were to pass this amendment right now, we know that. We know that starting in 2019, we got to come up with an additional $250 million that's got to go to Medicaid. On top of that level of 30% growth that we've been seeing basically annually now,
right,
for the existing population. But aside from that, and this is really, really important for the state of Missouri, because we are, you know, we don't have a lot of discretion in Medicaid. And the federal government doesn't like that. It was part of the compromise to get Medicaid passed, that states would still retain some control. Otherwise, it never would have, the senators and congressmen never would have passed it if they couldn't make the argument back home that they still had some control. Well, since it passed, I mean, a lot of that's been eroded away, and the federal government does not like that. Because what that means is when you're the federal government, it's more efficient for you to have all 50 states on the same playing field for you to regulate. And when they're at apples and oranges on their threshold level, like at 22% of the federal poverty level that we're at, which arguably is low, no doubt about it, that's substantially different from Illinois and New York and other states that are pretty much already at 133%.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, the Affordable Care Act is not that big of a deal for them. They already are doing it. Okay? So for us, it's a big jump, 22% to 133%. But here's why it's important. Because right now, another thing that's apples and oranges is the reimbursement level. And that 60-40 that we've got, Illinois is about at 50-50. So what's going to happen when you're the federal government and you start planing out that playing field? So now you can compare state to state because your standards are the same for everybody.
Yep.
We all get to 133%, 138%, however you want to calculate it. Illinois is at 50-50, we're at 60-40. And it may only be 10%, but it represents billions of dollars. Well, how long before Dick Durbin or somebody from Illinois says, well, you know, that's not fair. Illinois is paying 50%, Missouri's only paying 40%. We got to fix that. And it will be fixed.
Yep. Yeah.
And it will not be fixed at 60-40 because right. the feds don't want to pay that extra money. It's going to get fixed at 50-50 or worse for the states. And when that happens, it's going to pale that $250 million of general revenue per year. It's going to be over $1 billion, probably closer to $2 billion a year of general revenue that we're going to have to cough up. And there's only one way. I mean, you can take all the money pretty much from public education down to the bare bones, and you're still going to need more. That would precipitate a massive tax increase. It's the only way we could pay for it mm-hmm. in the state of Missouri.
That's right. I agree.
Or you completely strip public education. But we can't make these decisions today and say, well, just look at today. Look at this population. Don't look down the road. Don't look at 2019. Don't look at 2020, 2021 when these things are going to happen. Some of them we absolutely know will happen. Some of them we can pretty much read the tea leaves and say what will happen. But that's where we're headed. We cannot afford it.
Right. So the reality is not just where do we want to go, it's where are we today. And I would argue that this whole debate about Medicaid, are we going to expand, are we not going to, I think we're missing the fundamental problem here. The problem is not how many people are we going to put on the system. The problem is not, you know, we're not doing enough or we need to take federal free money or whatever. The problem, in my opinion, is we're not talking about how do you deliver better care in a personalized way that actually changes the outcome of health. And that is what's missing from this. This is all a debate about coverage. It's not a debate about people and how do you change the way that we deliver care that actually makes people healthy and improves their quality of life.
No doubt about
it. I would argue, Senator, we are doing a disservice to people to just put more people in this broken system.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Because also timely, that just came out really in the last month, is data from the states of Washington and Oregon. Because remember, a lot of states did the equivalent of what the Affordable Care Act requires before the feds required it. Those are states that did. So they've been doing it for a couple years now, and they've got some empirical data to show how it works. And what's come out of those two states as recently as the last month is outcomes where you do expansion are no better. Utilization of the emergency room as basically primary care, which is a huge cost that supposedly we're trying to avoid, does not change. In fact, it increases proportionately. So right now we know there's a large percentage using the emergency room in a way that it's not designed and it adds a lot of cost on that 900,000 that we have. Well, you can just take that trend and add 300,000 or 400,000 more people onto it and you will get that much more utilization of the emergency room. Because there's nothing that prevents that. And that will continue to happen. And that's what the data out of Washington and Oregon now show.
And the only thing that changes, I mean, so what this is really a discussion about is how many people are you going to pay for? There's nothing in part of this in this discussion that changes how people behave. There's nothing in this that changes their health outcomes. I mean, we are the debate we're having right now is all about financial issues.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that if we're really going to have a true discussion about healthcare and healthcare policy, it is so much larger than that.
Oh, much larger.
And so I don't believe, I actually believe this, I believe that we are doing a disservice to the people of this state to continue to put more money in this broken system. We're faulting, in my opinion, we're hurting the taxpayers who have to pay for it. As importantly, we're hurting the people that we're adding to it because we're putting them into a broken system. But you know the people that I think we're really hurting? And that is that group of individuals in our state, in our communities, that are the most vulnerable. The mental people that really have nowhere else to go.
Hmm?
Those seniors who have no one else left in their life. I mean, there is a segment of our population that as a civilized society, we have agreed to help take care of them.
No doubt about it.
But, Senator, it's not 25% of our population. It's not 16% of our population. And right now we're doing that 5 to 6%, that true segment of people who need help, we're doing them a great disservice because of the way that we are running this broken system.
That's true. I'm glad you mentioned those numbers because with expansion, we're pushing a quarter, between a fifth and a quarter of the population of the state of Missouri getting health care paid for by the rest of Missouri.
Well, we're at 16 to 18% now,
close
to 18% today. I mean,
right.
Stop and think about that. I remember in 2005, right before we changed Medicaid, that fiscal year, there were 1.1 million people on Medicaid. And in that same year, there were like 2.1 million taxpayers. So think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Every two taxpayers were funding a person on Medicaid.
Right.
You can't sustain those numbers. It's not fundamentally fiscally possible.
Right. But as opposed to the gradual 30% worsening that we've seen on the burden on taxpayers really since 2009, this would be an exponential jump, really.
That's right.
From that trend, which, again, nobody's talking about. But the other thing you pointed out, too, is you look at the other things that get funded here. And I've really highlighted how public education is underfunded because of our Medicaid obligations.
That's right.
But, you know, what have we done with prisons? We've cut them down to the bare bone. We're basically decriminalizing things that at some point were determined to be bad things and that things that somebody should be in prison for, but we made the decision, well, we got to put money towards Medicaid so we can't pay for the prisons, so let some more prisoners out.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. That's the discussion we're now having. We're now moved to the point of we're saying, let's let people out of prison because our prisons are full. I mean, that doesn't change behavior, Senator.
Right. I absolutely agree with you, Senator.
I know the president is busy reading his text messages,
he's reading
but I think
emails.
There's three senators on the floor. Welcome back.
Three senators on the floor. The senator from Barry.
Mr. President, I ask that we lay this bill over.
The bill shall be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, without objection, the Senate will go to order business to report to standing committees, and I have a report.
Reports of standing committees, send it forward.
Wow.
Secretary, read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill No. 653, begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill No. 650, begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Joint Resolution No. 30, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Respectfully submitted, Senator Richard, Chairman.
Senator from the 23rd.
Would you please refer, where is it here, Senate Joint Resolution 30 to the Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight Committee?
Will be referred.
And would you please refer Senate Concurrent Resolution 31 to the Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics?
It shall be referred. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to order of business for announcements, and I have an announcement.
Announcement. Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. In a moment, I'm going to make a motion to recess till 4:30. I'll let the committees do their business, and then we'll come back at 4:30 for a little while. We'll continue on the Senator from Barry's bill on Senate Bill 515 and continue the debate.
Further announcements. Senator from Johnson.
Yeah, inquire of you.
State your inquiry.
Do you believe in personal responsibility?
Not appropriate, Senator.
Do we have a rule if people break state equipment about reimbursement and responsibility for that?
There's no such rule.
There's no such. Do you think there should be?
Do you have an inquiry that's worthy of a response from the chair?
I'll do an announcement instead. How's
announcements.
That?
Senator from Johnson.
Your hardworking education committee will start promptly at 3 o'clock. We'll go into executive session, so if all the committee members can be there right at 3 o'clock, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Further announcements. Chair would like to make an announcement that the Senate Committee on Jobs, Economic Development, and Local Government will meet upon recess here at 1 o'clock in the Senate Lounge. Further announcements? Hearing none. Senator from Newton.
No further business coming from the body. I move the Senate stand at recess till 4:30 p.m. this day.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from Newton. All those of the opinion that motion shall prevail say aye.
Aye.
Those of the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate shall stand in recess until 4:30 p.m. this day.